Okay, and we're back. Hour number three. This is going to be a fascinating walk through history, and it will be something that many of you will never forget, because many of you probably know very little about World War II. World War II was the pivotal event of the last century, in a military sense. An enormous conflict. World War II, also known as of the, they call it the Second World War most commonly, was a global war, truly a global worldwide war that began in 1939 and ended in 1945 and included the vast majority of the world's nations, all of the great powers, and many, many other countries. There were two opposing military alliances, the Allies and the Axis. It was the most widespread war in history, with more than 100 million people serving in military units. In a state of total war, the major participants placed their entire economic, industrial, and scientific capabilities at the service of the war effort, erasing the distinction between civilian and military resources. This was an astounding event, marked by significant events involving the mass death of civilians, including the Holocaust and the only use of nuclear weapons in warfare. World War II, or the Second World War, resulted in 50 million, some say up to 75 million, fatalities. These deaths make World War II by far the deadliest conflict in all of human history. 50 to 75 million dead. And many died after the war, of course, in war-related actions of many different types. There are organizations, of course, online and around the world which seek to keep the history of that period of time available and accurate. Some would call them revisionist. I don't. I call them really historical accountants. Nothing wrong with bringing history into accord with the facts. One of the most interesting has to do with the U-boat war, primarily in the Atlantic, but certainly U-boats ranged the Pacific as well, as they traveled, well, basically around the world. They went to Japan and other areas. The organization is called Shark Hunters. You can find them very simply at sharkhunters.com. Shark Hunters International Incorporated, proudly bringing, it says on the top of its homepage, the honest history of the U-boat Waffe to light for nearly 7,400 members in 76 different countries since 1983. Shark Hunters. And the man who is behind it all and holds it together and is its leader is Harry Cooper. And we're very honored to have Harry with us tonight. We're going to talk about things again that some of you had never heard before, and hopefully you'll share with others. Harry, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Jeff.
This war that left 50 to 75 million dead and God knows how many injured, how many displaced permanently, the treason at the highest levels during the war. We can look at Yalta for openers and many other things that we don't even have access to. It was something that was so enormous and so huge when you tell people or younger people that there were no computers. There was no television. They don't believe it.
Yeah, I know.
This was men and some women and machines. These were machines, highly efficient, brilliantly designed machines in the air, on land, on the water, and, of course, underwater. And that's what Shark Hunters is all about. Tell us
right.
A little bit more about the organization, Harry, would you please?
I'll be happy to. Started out many years ago, back in the middle 70s, I was Grand National Stock Car Racer, and I was also an executive with a company. One thing led to another, and I quit my job, sold everything, bought a 30-foot sailing yacht, went and lived in the Bahamas, and I ran across an island that had been a plantation during the war years, and the old caretaker. There was a ruins of a mansion on a hilltop and a barracks building and a radio shack, and the old caretaker told me that they had given fresh water and food to German U-boats. And, of course, my first thought, them dirty Nazis, because that's what
well,
we were taught.
We're all condemned. Let me just stop for a moment and point out to all of our listeners, and this is a very intelligent audience, but all of you listeners who don't know, please keep in mind that we, as a populace in this country and much of the Western world, have been insidiously, viciously brainwashed and programmed to hate Germany reflexively.
Yeah, it is
as wrong as it could possibly be. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. I was a kid during the war years, and we were taught that they hated God but prayed to Hitler, and the machine gun helped us men in the water for sport. Okay, so I put that in the back of my head because I was still living on my boat in the islands, and it was a good life until one day I ran out of money, had to come home, get a job.
Well,
and,
wake up call. Yeah. Now, let me go back to this island. This was an island that apparently was some kind of a supply stop-off for some U-boats?
It was an unusual island. Most of the islands in the Bahamas are long and skinny. This one was round, 3-mile diameter, and had 26 freshwater wells. It was a working plantation owned by a guy named Guy Baxter, who was a Brit, but he didn't like the crown because the crown was taxing the Bahamians pretty heavily.
Yeah.
And so we never did confirm or wash that story out. But when I got back to the real world, went back to work as vice president of a company, I started to research and I found out, this was all propaganda. During wartime, propaganda is a fair weapon. You can't tell your soldiers, the guy in the other uniform, he loves his country like you love yours. He's got a wife and kids.
And
he goes to the same church as you do. Now go kill him. So you have to come out with those stories. Their belt buckle, as most people know, said, Gott mit uns, God is with us. So obviously they didn't pray to Hitler. Mm-hmm. And the guys in the U-boat, the U-Boot-Waffe, they were not allowed to belong to any political party whatsoever. So then I realized that they had the worst attrition rate of any military force ever in history.
Horrible.
Yeah. As a comparison, the U.S. Navy submarine service lost one man out of seven. That was the worst attrition rate on the American side. One man out of seven was killed. On the German U-boat side, it was the reverse. One man out of seven came home. And they were still standing in line to sign up at the end of the war when they knew they didn't have much chance of coming home. So I thought it's just wrong for things to go into history that are false. And so I started. The 2nd of February, 1983, I sent a one-page letter to about six people, and I thought that was as many people in the world that were interested in the U-boats. We're now up to a little more than I'm going to have to change the web page. We're up to 7,700 members now in 76 countries, minus, unfortunately, a lot who have passed on. About 1,000 have passed on.
Mm-hmm. The German Navy had U-boats in World War One.
Yeah.
But you're primarily dealing with U-boats of World War Two. Now, they pretty much pioneered the science. That kind of engineering and technology was theirs. They were really good at it.
Yeah, that's correct. We say the Germans wrote the book on submarine warfare. The U.S. Navy has kind of copied it and improved it, but the rest of the world never really got on board with submarine warfare.
In 1939, when the war began, what was the state of the German U-boat fleet? How many did they have, and how much transitional work was going on all the time? The R&D was terrific, I understand.
Yeah, and the R&D was also in secret. Most people don't realize that Germany was not allowed submarines by the
Treaty of Versailles.
Treaty of Versailles, correct. Yeah. But in I think it was 1934, 35, something like that, the German Navy, the Kriegsmarine, teamed up with some of their major builders, like Deutsches Werft, which was owned by Krupp. They moved into Holland, and they built a firm in Holland that was building submarines for other countries, but they weren't delivering them. They kept giving them sea trials, and then suddenly the war opened, and they had submarines already. Mm-hmm. They only had 57 submarines. Most of them were the Type 2 coastal boat, which the sailors called the dugout canoes. 250 tons, four officers, 21 men. Three torpedo tubes forward, and they carried two spare torpedoes, so and they couldn't go very far.
And that's what they started the war with.
Yeah, and they had about a dozen Type 7s, like you see in the movies, in the old Wolfpack movies.
Uh-huh.
They could go out on the far side of England and return, but the bases at that time, remember, were all in Germany. They had no French bases yet.
Yes, yes, yes. We have a break, but we're going to go right through it. I want to get as much information as I can out there this hour.
I think
many of the people listening have seen Das Boot, and I hope so.
Oh, yeah.
Probably the most, well, as realistic a war film as ever. It just doesn't get any more real than that.
True.
And I remember the U-boat going back to its I don't know what the name of the base was. It was in France, I believe.
That was
heavily,
not there.
Was it? Yeah. Heavily fortified, tremendous concrete works, huge buildings, and the bands were there and everything. And then, of course, at the end of the war, they came back and things were much different. But it was an extraordinary movie, and I would urge all of you to see this film if you haven't, Das Boot. All right, so they started the war with just an incredibly small number of U-boats. Now, you ask the average American who even remembers the war, the Second World War, and he would say, oh, they had hundreds of U-boats, they dominated the seas, and on and on and on. And the only way we ever beat them was we got lucky and we cracked their code. Now, let me ask you to correct that for me, if you would.
Well, they started the war with 57 submarines, and like I say, only about a dozen of them that were open water boats. After a point, they did have a huge number of submarines. We were not lucky to crack the code. They had like 10,000 people working on it round the clock at Bletchley Park. And the code, the codes were not as unbreakable as the Germans thought. Every once in a while, Admiral Dönitz would mention to the high command that he thought the codes had been broken, and they pretty well laughed his concerns away. No, these codes are unbreakable. Yet, before the war started, even, the Enigma machine was in use to counter spying from company to company. It was a three-wheel Enigma. Polish army got a hold of one, and that started the Allies understanding how the Enigma worked. When one submarine was sunk, I forget the name or the number, but they took the wheels off the Enigma machine and put them into their pocket so that they could abandon ship and then drop the wheels into the ocean. One guy forgot to take them out of his jumper, and three of the Enigma wheels fell into Allied hands early in the war.
Uh-huh. Did that prove to be a fateful development for the entire war, or did it cause peripheral damage?
At that point, it was just kind of the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time they got to what's called Black May, May of 1943, the codes were cracked, and the U.S. came out with what was called HFDF, High Frequency Directional Finder. The Germans thought, and correctly so up to this point, they thought that if they just sent out a quick burst, what they call a Kurt signal, a quick signal, like 3 or 4 seconds long with a series of numbers and letters that told where they were, what their fuel state was, what their torpedo loading was, et cetera, et cetera. They thought nobody could zero in on them with the standard RDF, which was true. But when HFDF came online, the minute that radio man hit the key, he was triangulated by large, high-powered receivers on the African continent, North America, and Canada.
Oh, this stretched geographically all across the ocean, then. That's how they triangulated them.
That's correct. And within 15 minutes, there was either bombers overhead or there was a hunter-killer group. This was from Black May of 43 onward. The German Navy lost almost as many submarines that month alone as the U.S. Navy did in the entire war.
Wow.
We lost 52 submarines, but only, I think, 48 from combat losses.
Uh-huh.
They lost 44 submarines that month alone.
That's heartbreaking, I'm sure, for any military. This is tragic. Why didn't Dönitz prevail and say, listen, we're going to change these codes no matter what, every 90 days or something? Or what's the deal?
They changed them, but as fast as they changed them, they got them broken. Huh. I thought, you know, I'm not a general or anything like that, but I would think to prove his point, he would have sent out a false message under code that on such and such a day, some submarine would have Adolf Hitler on board and
yes.
such and such location and see
yes.
how much
traffic he pulled, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that
yeah.
never happened, and and every time a submarine sinks, anybody's submarine, usually the entire crew goes down with it because they operate alone as opposed
right.
to surface ships.
Yeah.
When they're sunk, they've got a bunch of people around them, other ships, to pick them up. When a submarine goes down, and only if it's on a surface, you might have some guys get off. If you're running at 200, 300 feet down, nobody gets off. It's all over.
Yeah,
and the German boats had anywhere, depending on the boat, anywhere from 44 to about 55 men on board.
Each one. This
yep.
is remarkable. What was the average length of one of these, 200 to 300 feet? Something
well,
like
it depends. The Type 7, which was the one you see on Das Boot all the time, that was your Type 7, which runs 220 feet
mm-hmm.
and about 760 tons. The later variants went up to about 1,000 tons. The other ones, the long-range boats, the Type 9, Type 9C, excuse me, like U-505 in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
that was 252 feet long and was a little over 1,000 tons. As compared to the American sub, the fleet boats were 312 feet long and came in at 1,600 tons or better.
Mm-hmm. Have you been to Chicago? I grew up in
Chicago.
Yeah, well, you were right there. Are they taking care of that that boat?
They are now. I was a kid, and we were going to Granddad's farm in Michigan,
mm-hmm.
and we're coming down Lakeshore Drive, and there's a big sign that says, Danger U-Boat Crossing, and I'm thinking, what the heck is going on?
Yeah.
And there it was, floating in Lake Michigan, Labor Day of 1954, my 15th birthday, and we went on field trips from high school, but it wasn't until I got interested in shark hunters that I went down there. Oh, man, I've got more hours on that boat than some of the crew.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, in my opinion, unfortunately, they changed directors at the museum about 10 years ago. And the guy that was there before, Jack Kahn, he was very open and easy to talk to, and we gave him suggestions. The new guy, David Messino, he used to run the buses in Chicago. And for the first time in a century and a half, they started charging admission to go in the door. And I understand the submarine's in a beautiful place, but the guides know as much about that boat
as they do
history,
a city bus. Yeah.
As I do about brain surgery.
Mm-hmm. I see.
One of our members was through there, and the guide was telling them that when the submarine was captured, some of the guys had American money in their pocket and American cigarettes because they had come ashore in the Carolinas to buy bread, which is an old, stupid story.
Yeah.
And I tried to explain to the people at the museum that this submarine was never off the American coast. It was off the African coast when it got caught.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's, from what I understand, it's beautifully maintained. And that museum is probably one of the most unique in the whole world. It's a great place.
There is footage of that capture, as I recall.
That's correct. And it's on one of the DVDs we sell.
Mm-hmm. Now, Harry's marvelous historical website, sharkhunters.com, has such extensive data, and as you know, the German military, Navy, all the German military, was really profoundly interested in accurate data. You can track how many submarines on your site now. How many, you've got the history of so many of these boats.
Right. We stopped putting them up on the website after a while because we publish a monthly magazine that goes to our members, and we highlight, depending on the submarine, if it's not much history, 6 or 7 per month.
Yes.
If it's something like U-505, that takes a lot. But we have our archive, which is the largest in the Western world on U-boats. It's second largest in the world. So any of our members who want any information about these boats at all, it's free, and it's accurate, unlike these Johnny-come-lately websites.
Yeah.
Those guys have never met a U-boater. All the great commanders were members of Shark Hunters. I had my own room in Otto Kretschmer's house.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, what an honor. Wow.
Oh, what a fantastic man he was. Yeah. Honorable, decent.
Yeah.
And his wife was a sweetheart, nice lady.
I'm so tired of this twisted media and you know who trying to paint these people out to be Lucifer's right hand. They were people. They were brave, like American mariners and submariners or any nations. They were fighting for their country, which was about the size of Texas or smaller, and really fighting against astonishing odds and fighting like supermen in some ways. I'm not knocking anybody else, but these people deserve credit that I couldn't even begin to approach to adequately discover verbally and deliver.
Yeah.
It's astounding what they did.
They were incredibly honorable in the early stages of the war before anti-submarine efforts got to be really good.
Yes.
They would frequently stop by the survivors of the ships they had just sunk and make sure that they had fresh water.
Absolutely, it's true.
When U-505 sank one of the ships, I forget which one, they actually had their corpsman go on board the lifeboats and give first aid to some of the people.
Yeah.
One of our members was a merchant skipper, and he was sunk in the Atlantic by a German U-boat, and while they're bobbing around in the lifeboats, the submarine came over by them since he was the skipper, and they asked what ship, what tonnage, et cetera, what was the cargo. And then the skipper asked if they needed any first aid. He said, no, everybody was fine. And the U-boat skipper said, I'd like to give you some fresh water, but ours is all spoiled. Would you guys like a couple of cases of beer instead?
Oh.
So they gave them the beer, and they gave them coordinates to get to shore, and these guys all made it.
Well, you see, you mentioned the word honor, and that was something that the German military practiced more than anyone else on the battlefield, and I can say that with assuredness. It's true. Americans don't want to hear that necessarily, but it's all true. I mean, you look at the Luftwaffe, American aces. How many shoot-downs did an American have to score to become an ace?
Well, in any military, it's five shoot-downs,
five aerial
victories to be an ace.
All right. For you folks who don't know, the leading ace of all time was in the German Luftwaffe.
Yeah.
His name was Erich Hartmann. Eric Hartmann shot down 352, I believe it was.
352 confirmed. He was a member of Shark Hunters also until he passed away.
Was he? And when you say confirmed, they had very strict rules about confirming a shootdown. So Hartmann's actual shootdown was probably considerably more than that. But these people, like I say, were fighting all the time over their heads with little rest because of the burden put upon them by the war.
Right.
Amazing. Stand by, Harry, if you would. We have to take a break. We'll come right back in just a couple minutes. The website, again, is fascinating, sharkhunters.com. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the myths and misconceptions that are common and pervaded by the Western media as regards to some of these boats and what they may or may not have been doing as we continue. Okay, welcome back. Talking to Harry Cooper of SharkHunters.com. Harry, how many U-boats were commissioned and saw active duty in World War II, and how many came back, approximately?
Okay, approximately, yeah. There were about 1,200 built, commissioned, etc., and close to 1,000 went down.
Only 200 came back, approximately.
Yeah. Towards the end of the war, as I say, after Black May, one boat out of 10 came back from their first patrol. Most of them didn't come back from their very first patrol.
Oh.
Well, and they had, you know, their training time had to be cut shorter and shorter because they were losing boats faster and faster.
Yes.
So in the last months of the war, the average age of a skipper was 23. And the average age of a crewman was about 18 years old.
Kids.
Of course, when I joined the service, I was 18. I was a kid, but I went through 6 months intensive training in weapons, et cetera. mm-hmm. before I even got to an active base. These guys just rush them in, rush them through, and they had handbooks that they had to read.
One out of 10 boats sent on first patrol came back. That was it.
Yeah.
9 of 10 lost. They'd salute. The crews would be on board. They'd leave port, never to be seen again.
Sadly, that's what happened.
There are 1,000 U-boats sitting on the bottom of the
yep.
ocean.
Yep.
All over the place.
Yeah.
Is there any reason to consider trying to pull some of them up?
We had crossed that bridge early on 30 years ago when shark hunters first got started.
Yes.
Now, there's not much that looks like a U-boat because the sea is not very pleasant. The salt water mm-hmm. disintegrates the stuff. Our members dive on some of the boats. Our members have found some of the boats. And, you know, the outer casing mm-hmm. was only like a 16th of an inch thick.
Nobody can believe that when you tell them. These things were, you could go up to and just tap them with your finger and move the metal almost. It was that thin.
The pressure hull itself was about an inch thick with
right.
a lot of ribs inside, but the outer skin, which was the ballast tanks and the fuel tanks, they didn't need to carry pressure because they were all open at the bottom. They had they had open ports at the bottom, so when uh-huh. they wanted to flood, all they did was open the valves at the top.
Yeah.
And the fuel was taken out from the top of the fuel tanks hmm. because the salt water was coming in at the bottom and the fuel floated on the salt water.
So we're talking an average crew of 40 per boat.
44 to 50 for the Type 7s and then 46 to 55 for the Type 9s.
So
there was special operation.
1,000 times 40 is a lot of men.
Yeah, they didn't lose quite 40,000. They had 39,000 that signed up, but 32,000 did not come home. And we have the most complete list of uh-huh. the men lost anywhere in the world because the guys at the U-Bootskameradschaft, in other words, the Submarine Veterans Association in mm-hmm. Kiel, mm-hmm. they keep the official book and it's handwritten. They put that in my hands many years ago so I could bring it back here, put it all up on the computer, which I did. And that's an incredible trust to give me the only record they had of all their lost men.
Yes.
And I brought it back to them. But then through other sources, we found, if a guy was washed overboard, he was not on that list. Or if a guy was killed in an air attack, but the boat continued, he was not listed.
Mm-hmm.
If he was at home on leave and killed in a bombing, he was not listed. So we added those.
I see.
Also at the German Submarine Memorial in a suburb of Kiel. This is where they got the idea for the curved wall for the Vietnam Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
They have this over there, a curved wall, only with bronze plaques. Every submarine that was sunk is listed there with the name of the skipper, whether he was killed or not, and then the name of everybody who was lost in combat.
As it should be.
Yeah, and it's a somber
mm-hmm.
sight. And then the sad thing, you and I know about the brainwashing, every once in a while, some thugs go through there and they splash paint on these bronze plaques, bust the flower pots.
Yeah.
And the old ladies who are widows of the men who were lost wind up taking the bus out there on the weekend. And here you see these 85, 90-year-old people cleaning up the mess that these thugs have made.
And they still love their husbands, too.
Yes. And the German government, of course, you think if they had any decency at all, they would put an honor guard there, like we do at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. No, as far as their government is concerned, it's World War what? Adolf who?
Yeah, well, that government is... Germany has been, unfortunately, tragically, in the hands of world Zionism since the war ended, basically.
They're also still occupied by the U.S.
That's right. And people don't understand also that between 1945 and 1953, between 5 and 8 million Germans were killed, eliminated, liquidated. They were all done in. All the nationalists, the Zionists went in there and slowly but surely went through all the ranks of those who still believed in Germany.
Yeah.
and had anything to say about it and got rid of them.
There were over a million were deliberately starved to death in the Eisenhower starvation camp.
I've covered that at length here. James Bach's book, Other Losses.
He called us before he was doing that book for advice and help, and I told him I thought it was a wonderful idea. He's a little bit, he's not very smooth, let's put it that way. He said, well, you have many German veterans. I said, yeah, about 1,000 German veterans in membership. He says, okay, you will give me their addresses and phone numbers so I can contact them. I said, no, we never give out contact information for any reason, but I will arrange interviews with as many as you want. No, you will give it to me now. And I said, well, goodbye. I've been in one of those, the memorial to one of those camps. And you see that they're either 17 or 16-year-old kids, or they're 45-year-old men, which is old for combat.
Yeah.
And they all died in early July, which would be just enough time to starve to death.
For you folks who don't know, what he's talking about is Eisenhower's Holocaust on German military men, rounded up in the mud, barbed wire, and left to die. Liquidated, killed, slaughtered.
No barrack building, nothing. Mess hall because they didn't eat, no latrine.
No.
No one was allowed to bring them water or food.
No, this is beyond belief. This is supposed to be land of the free, home of the brave. I'm not knocking American servicemen or women at all. They were heroic.
Right.
They fought for their country. But let's be honest. Eisenhower, Churchill, Montgomery, far from angels.
Let's not forget Bomber Harris.
Madman Harris, slaughtered how many German civilians? God only knows, and God isn't
talking.
Hundreds
of thousands in the firebombing of Dresden.
Alone.
Yeah.
These people were beasts. They were far from what the history books portray them to be.
Look on the good side. If you lead a good life and go to heaven when you die, you won't run across these guys.
That's for damn sure. All right, when we come back, Harry, I'd like you to correct some of the... Let's talk about Hitler's escape to Antarctica, South America, the U-boat that was supposedly sunk off the East Coast, which had
a super secret
cargo. And there are lots of things that unfortunately have a life of their own on the Internet. But let's try and clear some of those up when we come back. No,
yes,
forget it. We're not going to come back. I'm going to go right on through this break, too. So let's go on with that. What about this this East Coast U-boat? I'd like to hear about that.
Talk about a fairy tale. When this first came out, 15 or so years ago, I contacted the guy. I thought he was making an honest mistake. And I contacted him, and I said, wait a minute. You're saying there was a submarine sunk in 25 feet of water. A submarine draws 20 feet of water when it's running on the surface, so if it sank in 25 feet of water, there's a whole lot of submarines sticking up out of the water. And he claimed that they were caught because the skipper was sending a radio message back to U-boat headquarters, only he was transmitting in English and using the U.S. Coast Guard frequency. And I said, what the heck kind of logic is this? Well, then I found out that this guy is the same guy who allegedly found this freighter about a year ago, sunk with over $1 billion worth of platinum on board. And that was just as phony. There are two guys up there. I won't name them because I don't want to bring lawyers on your show. But if you gave them enough money, they could convince you that they know where there is a German U-boat sunk in the Sea of Tranquility, which, as you and I know, is on the
moon.
And they never find anything, but they bleed people for money. The Boston Herald and the Boston Globe both got caught up in this way back when it started, the U-boat off the East Coast there of Cape Cod. And they were going to send expeditions out to find it. I got a hold of both the guy at the Globe, I can't remember his name, and the guy at the Herald, Jules Crittenden, and I told them both, what I just told you, it's a farce, it's baloney. Okay, the guy at the Globe pulled back. The guy from the Herald, Jules Crittenden, he funded an expedition, or he got the paper to fund an expedition, and he came back. I said, well, other than getting wet, what happened? Oh, yeah, you're right, there's no submarine there. Living in Florida here, as I do, every dive shop you go to on the coast, they'll tell you there's a Nazi U-boat. Can't be a German one. It's got to be a Nazi U-boat.
Always.
Sunk right out there.
You can almost see it.
Hundreds of tons of gold on
gold
board.
Many
of them have Adolf Hitler's body. But
right.
The Navy has draped a steel net over it, and the Coast Guard will chase you away. So I ask him, well, why did the Navy do that? Why did the Coast Guard chase you away? Well, so you don't get the gold on board. So you ask him, well, why didn't the Navy get the gold? Oh, well, they got no answer.
I tell them,
up until a few years ago, I was a flotilla commander with the Coast Guard Auxiliary. I said, we'll go out there, we'll anchor, and I tell them I got $1,500 in a special account in the bank. You put me on the deck of any German U-boat sunk in Florida water, and you're $1,500 richer. The money is still in the bank. Because the guy who saw it turns out to be some drunk in a bar whose Aunt Matilda's pool cleaner overheard once. And they tell you some old-timer saw it go down. Yeah, sure, they go down. Submarines are meant to do that. They come back up again somewhere else. And if you look at the German record, every boat that operated in Florida waters came home. Another myth shot out the door.
Very interesting. One story I read about a Navy blimp which got very lucky, allegedly, and managed to score a hit on a U-boat off the East Coast. I don't know which U-boat that would be. Is there any truth to that story? It was a Navy blimp.
Yeah, K-74 was the blimp, allegedly.
Uh-huh.
And the U-boat shot it down, and it got a lucky hit on the submarine, allegedly, which was U-233.
Uh-huh.
And according to, that's the same two guys up in New England.
Oh, I see.
And they claim that the blimp was shot down by the submarine, and it turns out some of the crew said, no, we just didn't pay attention, and it was in the fog, and we crashed. As far as the submarine, they claim it was a very rare Type 11,
mm-hmm.
which was so rare that it never got off the drawing board. They never made any of them.
That's pretty rare.
Yeah, that's real rare. And the submarine U-233 was actually a Type 10 mine-laying boat that was sunk by four or five U.S. Navy destroyers 1,000 miles off the American coast. It did not sneak into Casco Bay and sink and let everybody
I see.
Die.
All right. Now, there is some extraordinary footage, I assume it's legitimate, taken at night from a U-boat somewhere in New York Harbor. Is this true?
Yeah, well, not in the harbor exactly, but several boats were there. The film you saw was with Eric Topp, who was also a good friend of mine. He was the third most successful submarine commander. He sank the first American warship by mistake. It was a month and a half before we got into the war. But he was never close enough to see that. That was filmed from another submarine mm-hmm. and tagged into his.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in January of 42, it was called Operation Paukenschlag. Paukenschlag means drumbeat, but it's kind of a ceremonial rolling on the kettle drums like in a Wagnerian opera.
Mm-hmm.
Six boats did come to attack the U.S. We had no anti-submarine effort in place at all,
mm-hmm.
and they had a wonderful time over here, sinking ships left and right. All the cities were lit up so the submarines would stay seaward of the shipping lanes, and it was like shooting ducks in a gallery.
Well, it's said that the Americans could see the ships burning as they went down.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But all the time. And the guy who sank the first ship in American waters, that was off the coast of New York, Captain Hartigan, Reinhard Hartigan, who he said he could see the swimmers on Coney Island with his binoculars because he was running on the surface. During the daytime. Yeah.
Wow.
And in about 8 weeks, he turns 100 years old. He's member number 102 out of our 7,700 members.
Yeah, good for him.
Yeah, he's a neat old guy.
I'd say.
He was playing golf up until about a year ago.
Well, amazing man. Amazing men.
Yeah.
Not just Germans, but Americans, Brits. There were some heroic people all around.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We're not pushing anybody aside here. All right. One quick question. How successful were some of the U-boats in fighting off aerial attacks? Some of them had some pretty formidable armament topside. Were they able to shoot down any aircraft?
Yeah, some of them shot down the aircraft, but no matter what armament they had. They were really sitting ducks to airplanes. They came up with one clever idea. The U-441 was termed the U-flak trap. It got damaged to where it really couldn't submerge, so Admiral Dönitz decided to load it up with anti-aircraft. They had 20 millimeters all over this thing, and they went out in the Bay of Biscay, and some of the coastal, a coastal command bomber came by, and boy, this thing just lit up the sky. So the coastal command bomber just circled out of range, called in half a dozen more aircraft, and so they split the fire and beat that boat all to hell. It was the ship's doctor that got it back because the rest of the officers were killed. So they had very little defense against airplanes.
Right.
And then after Black May of 45, and then we came out with the Hedgehog also, which went
Black May of four, Black May of 42 or 43.
I'm sorry, 43. Black May of 43.
Okay.
Yeah, and then that was pretty much the end. And then we came out with what they called the Mark 14 airdrop torpedo. Mm-hmm. Airdrop mine. They called it a mine because it was so secret.
Mm-hmm.
It was nicknamed Fido. It was really a torpedo. It was dropped by an airplane, and they called it Fido because it was like a friendly dog. It would snuggle up next to you, and what it did, it locked onto the sound of the submarine's propellers, and there was no escape from that thing. It came right up and blew the back end out of the submarine.
Wow. Well, technology. Technology. All
well,
right.
True. Don't forget how Adolf Hitler got out here.
Okay. Did he or didn't he get out on a submarine?
I can't say on a submarine. He got out originally by air. There's no question. Now, I know half your audience is thinking that this boy ought to be in a rubber room. We have, over the years, we have dug out documents from the FBI, from the OSS, which was mm-hmm. the forerunner of the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
We've got hundreds of these documents. They all say they know he got away. And he left by submarine from a place called Villa Garcia, which is up the river from Vigo, Spain. And if you remember in Das Boot, there was German ships caught in the harbor that was supplying U-boats.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true. They had ships that would take turns in there. After the war was over, they'd be coming out of Vigo, Spain, and we have a book on that with all backup documents and photos, et cetera. It's called Escape from the Bunker, which came out some years ago, and now all of a sudden these two guys from England come out with something called Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler, and I'm told it reads a lot like our book.
Yeah, so. Plagiarism is the name of the game now.
Unfortunately.
All right, so he got out via submarine.
Yeah.
And,
so did a lot of people, Jeff, all the way until middle 1947.
Huh.
They had this rat line, they called it, going down there. And to pick up fresh water and food along the way, there's an island about 1,000 kilometers off Rio de Janeiro.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a rock 2.5 miles long by 1.5 miles wide, and it goes up to about 3,000 feet. It's owned by Brazil. And they keep a small contingent there of Navy guys, maybe 24. Their job is to raise the flag in the morning, take it down at night.
Mm-hmm.
And that way Brazil says, we own 200 miles of fishing around here.
Mm-hmm.
1938, they pulled their people off the island. And 1 week later, a German scientific task force got there. They built two 80-meter tall radio towers. We've got photos of them. And then from 40... They came back from 45 until 47. They had a German contingent there managing the island because they had herds of goats, herds of pigs, sea turtles, and they also had a lot of fresh water on this island. I was there in 2010. The Brazilian Navy took me out there,
mm-hmm.
and I was there for 3 days. I found the remains of the radio shack. Got pictures of them. People can go to our website, sharkhunters.com,
mm-hmm.
look on previous tours, and click on the Brazil part. So they were going down, and we know where they were coming in. Early in the war, a guy by the name of Garbers, Heinrich Garbers. Nobody ever heard of him, but he got a Knight's Cross. He had a 90-ton sailing ship that he would go down to this particular cove And he was bringing spies in and out all the time during the war. So were submarines, the black boats, we call them, which are submarines that didn't exist, you know, like we have.
Black ops, yeah.
That's right. And it continued until 2 years after the war. I was in the estate where Hitler lived after the war. I was there in 2008, also 2009. When the plane lands...
You were in the estate that he definitely was living in.
Right.
And this is in Argentina?
That's correct. In Patagonia, way out at the foothills of the Andes.
Uh-huh.
When the plane landed and I got off, it's where you were in Bavaria.
I understand.
The buildings, they all look that way. And we went to have dinner, and we were met by the owner of the restaurant, who was about 6 foot tall, maybe 80 years old, blue eyes, blonde hair, not your typical gaucho. He was explaining the specials of the day in Spanish, and I don't speak Spanish, and so my Argentine buddies were trying to explain it in English, and it wasn't working. So on a guest, I said, bitte mein Herr, ich möchte eine Speisekarte mit englischer Schreibe. Please serve it like an English menu. And immediately he comes back, oh, mein Freund, haben Sie nicht? We talked for 2 minutes in German, and then I said, you speak good German, why? And he says, well, ich bin Schweizer. I'm Swiss. Well, then, during the dinner, he was playing a Schifferklavier, which is German accordion without keys. It's all buttons. And he had a buddy playing a guitar and they're singing gaucho songs. And I asked him if he could play the Matrosenlied, the sailor song that the Ubers always sang when they were leaving port. No, he said, I don't know that one. Okay. So we're back eating some great Argentine beef, and suddenly we hear, like a golden beer and the thing, and he went through the entire Matrosenlied, then the Panzerlied. I gave him a thumbs up. He stood up, snapped his heels, and put his right arm up in the air.
Unreal.
Yeah.
So as far as we know, and other people had to know, world types, world leaders, that Hitler was alive, or was this a secret that was successfully kept until he died?
It was known by the world leaders. Stalin had told Truman and some of the others that he got away. The FBI, as I say, they knew where he was all the time.
Uh-huh. How old was he when he died, do we know?
It was in 1962, I believe. He stayed in this estate until 1955, and then the area was discovered as a tourist attraction, skiing in the winter. And we've got pictures of Scorzini and Rudel, his top pilot, skiing in the Andes down there by him. Well, what's wrong with skiing in Bavaria? But no, that's why they were there.
Otto Scorzini was down there. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. What a story.
Yeah. It's in another one of the books we have available.
Well, Harry, this has been a real honor to have you on the program. I mean that. What you've done is extraordinary. And to all your members, my best wishes. I salute honor and bravery wherever it comes from, and there is certainly a lot of it to be found at sharkhunters.com. And I thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been a pleasure.
All right, sir. Take care.
Good night.
Good night. Harry Cooper, sharkhunters.com. An extraordinary story, and you can take that to the bank. All right. We'll be right back in 21 hours. See you tomorrow night.